From the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University, this is Writer's Talk. I'm Doug Dangler. Pete Houtman published his first novel, Drawing Dead, in 1993, and has published 19 other novels since then, including 2004's Godless, which won the National Book Award for Young People's Literature. He's also co-written three Bloodwater mysteries with Mary Logue, and maintains an active interest in both poker and filming online book trailers in which he gets shocked. So we'll ask him about that. Welcome to Writer's Talk, Pete Houtman.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, let's start with the most shocking part of the intro to go with that and talk about the book trailers for your latest book, Blank Confessions. First, can you set Blank Confessions up for me?
Well, Blank Confession is, it opens up with a kid walking into a, 16-year-old boy walking into a police station saying that he's killed somebody. And it's a story told from two points of view. It's the point of view of the policeman that's interviewing the kid, and then from the point of view of the kid's friend, Mikey, who of course is telling a completely different story than Shane, the main character. So a lot of it takes place in an interview room with a very frustrated policeman and a very enigmatic Shane Blank, the main character.
Okay. What was the writing process like for you on this book? How did you get into the character? What made you want to work on a sort of a genre, not a genre film, but a well-established kind of police procedural outlook and then do something different with it?
Well, one of my favorite stories is Shane by Jack Schaefer, which is a book written for younger readers. It was published in 1952 and made into a even more famous film starring, was it Alan Ladd?
Yeah, I think so. He was...
Or Gary Cooper. I don't know.
No, I think it was Alan Ladd.
Okay. And I love that film, and I love all its iterations, the hundreds and hundreds of times it's been made over and over again. A stranger comes to town and takes the side of the downtrodden to battle against a more powerful and usually evil oppressor. I mean, most of Clint Eastwood's Westerns follow that formula, and I wanted to write that formula. But I didn't really want to do it as a Western. I wanted to take that classic shape of a story and do it in a modern setting. So I chose to do it in a medium-sized city, present day, with motorcycles instead of horses, and stun guns and tasers instead of guns. And as far as the police procedural part, I had the idea for this a particular sort of a cop that would interview the young offender and kind of tell the story backwards. I wanted to try a different way of organizing the story, something that I hadn't done before, which is what I kind of strive for in most of my books, to try something a little different each time.
Okay. And I think your book trailers are an attempt at that as well. You've got the book trailers for Blank Confession, which features you in a room.
My acting debut, and, you know, Philip Seymour Hoffman has nothing to worry about.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. I'd never acted before in any sense of the word, and I had decided to do this trailer, and I had an idea for kind of a goofy little story that sort of relates to the story in Blank Confession, but not really. Mm-hmm. And I was very self-conscious about doing a book trailer too, because, you know, a book trailer, who watches book trailers? I don't know. I don't know who watches them. I don't know if they make people buy books. But I just kind of had this idea. I wanted to try to produce a short little movie with me as the main character. So I got to sing, which is one of the most horrifying experiences that I've ever had, is listening to myself sing on tape.
Did you write it so that you would force yourself to sing?
I wrote it because I thought me trying to sing would be funny.
Okay.
And I guess some people might be amused by it, and some people might cover their ears and run screaming out of the room. Mm-hmm. After viewing the trailer, you know, in the process of editing it and so forth, after viewing the trailer, by the 10th or 15th time I heard myself singing Roxanne, I just I just turned the sound off. I mean, I couldn't even bear it anymore. But it was fun to do. And the whole movie making process, you know, it's 3 minutes. It's 3 1-minute segments on YouTube, and it took about 6 hours, which is by movie making standards pretty quick. Mm-hmm. It's a very meticulous kind of process, and I know a lot more about it than I did. I would probably write it differently now if I was going to do it over again.
What would be different about it if you were to write it now?
I thought a couple of the jokes didn't quite work. I would have to look at it to find specifics, but little ways that the lines were, particularly the ones delivered by the other actor, because I knew how my lines were going to sound coming out of me, but I didn't know what his lines were going to sound like until they happened.
Okay. You say on your blog, hey, when did authors go from being faceless loners to being indefatigable, self-promoting public figures with state-of-the-art websites, publicist booking agents, multimedia presentations, blogs, billboards, and coming soon, no doubt, skywriters. So tell me about, as an author, your take on diving into all of this. You said, you also say at some point maybe this started with Mark Twain and sort of some of the self-promotion he did. What in the time that you've been writing books, has it really changed? You feel like it's very different than it used to be? Or...
Yeah, it is. Well, when I started publishing, which was in the early 1990s, the main way that books were promoted was through book tours. And publishers would send authors to 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 bookstores. And people would come in to see the author, to meet the author, and to get their book signed. Well, by the end of the 1990s, in fact, in 2001, I went to do a book signing in Chicago. And my publisher put me up at Four Seasons Hotel, and you know, it was all very expensive, and I had one bookstore signing in the whole city. I was sure it was going to be packed because I knew I had a lot of readers there, and I hadn't been to Chicago in a long time. And I went to the bookstore. It was one of the Barber's bookstores, and two people showed up, and I was... More than anything, I was embarrassed. I was embarrassed because I knew that this had cost my publisher, you know, over $1,000 to send me there and to sell two books. And so I asked the bookstore owner, I said, you know, what is there, like a Bears and a Cubs game on the same time today? Or what's happening? He says, well, so, you know, we've had 31 author appearances at this store this month so far. It was only like the 18th of the month. And,
wow.
You know, what happened was that, like any other marketing idea, when everybody starts doing it, then the public becomes jaded. And, oh, another author's in town, ho-hum, you know. Let me know when Justin Bieber shows up. So that was, you know, that was at that, when I first started, that was an effective way to bring books to people. And now that's not so true. Mm-hmm. So people are trying other things. They're trying various, you know, internet based things like book trailers and blogs and so forth.
How do you like doing them? How did you like doing the movie?
I love doing the movie because it was challenging and it was new and it was something that I haven't done before. And I'm going to do another one. I'm going to do an animated one for The Big Crunch. Mm-hmm. I'm working on that now.
That's your novel that comes out in January.
That's in January, and I'm doing an animation that I'm building on my iPad, which is really pretty fun.
Is that going to be something that follows along with the book? Does it build on something in the book, or
well,
is it a sort of a standalone with the same characters?
No, it's going to be the name of the book is The Big Crunch, which is a theoretical cosmological event when the Big Bang reverses itself and everything crunches back together. So what I'm doing is an animation of the Big Bang and the Big Crunch.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see how it works.
Okay. Do you feel that these things are representing your books well, clearly, or are they just advertisement for it, or what's your take on it in terms of art?
Well, bottom line is they're the same thing as when, you know, I was 4 years old and I painted my face with my mom's lipstick and ran around telling everybody to look at me. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they sell books. If they do sell books, then I'll probably feel compelled to keep doing more of them.
Mm-hmm.
But they're fun.
Okay.
And I enjoy it. That's really, you know, I couldn't justify the expense of doing the blank confession video in terms of the book sales that it's likely to produce. That just, the numbers don't make sense. Mm-hmm. But in terms of broadening my own experience and keeping myself entertained and maybe entertaining a small core group of people that might come across it on the internet, that's valuable to me.
Okay. Now, you've got a blog that has recipes, discussions of writing, and your favorite one-star reviews of your books on Amazon. Where people comment on your book that it came to, they received it and it had been bent and folded. And yes, for this, you got a one star.
That's right.
And so it was a really difficult moment for you, I assume, going through that. But
I want to say something about that. That particular one star review was, you know, this book, the packaging was just terrible. The cover was bent. And so she gives it a one star review, which possibly impacts the number of books I sell. But so I was curious about this person, and I went and I looked at her other reviews, and she's in the packaging business, and all she does is all of her reviews have to do with product packaging.
How many different kinds of packaging can you have for books? That seems sort of an odd thing.
I don't know. You know, I'm waiting for the one where it's like the clamshell that you have to rent a saw to get open.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be a great way to package books.
If you could send it back, it might be a good idea if it were that sturdy.
Yes.
If it were reusable,
yes,
book packaging. So does blogging feel like writing to you? Do you feel...
Yeah.
Okay. Tell me about that. How?
Well, my blog is, as you mentioned, it's a lot of different things. I have some very specific instructions on how to poach eggs.
I tried some of those instructions, by the way.
Did it work?
It was, well, I'm not familiar with poached eggs.
Okay.
I have to start off with saying, but for something I'd never eaten before, it was edible.
Good.
And so I think that it went well, and there wasn't a lot of white left in the pan when I was done.
Okay.
Because I think you recommend stirring it.
No,
recommend stirring
it.
I knew there was a difference.
Stirring is for martinis.
Okay. Is that a different kind of poached egg? You have a poached egg martini as well?
No, just a martini, but I'm working on the martini recipe, and I'll be posting within the next 2 weeks my hash brown instructions. But the blog is like a catch-all. You know, anything that's on my mind is going to go on the blog. It isn't always necessarily book-related. It can be cooking stuff, mushrooms I've found interesting. I think yesterday morning I blogged about the what happened to the pumpkin that was sitting on my front steps when the squirrels found it.
Ravaged.
Just completely ravaged. There was less than half a pumpkin left. It was horrifying.
I didn't know that squirrels would eat pumpkins.
I didn't either, and I would have thought it was a deer or something, except I saw the squirrel out there on it, eating it twice.
Really? And there were squirrel tracks going away from it that led you to believe that...
Yes. So it's very important things in my blog. You know, I mean, it's kind of like a look into my brain in the most useless way possible.
Do you track that? Do you look at the kind of responses you get back from your readers?
I look at the comments. Every time somebody comments, I get a little email.
So does that impact you as a writer? You think they like this, I'm going to give them more of this on the blog, or maybe I'll talk about poached eggs more in my books or something like that? I'm curious about that, the feedback to you as a writer.
Yeah, it matters to me. It matters to me. I mean, you know, the one thing, you know, if I could say the one most important thing that I came to learn and accept when I was younger, when I was first starting writing, is that most writers start out by seeing writing as being a way that they can express themselves. This is kind of what draws them to it. And it's only later that they come to the point, not all of them do, and not all of them need to, where they say, oh, this is an act of communication. This is about the communication. And if I write this and nobody reads it, it's almost as though it doesn't exist. Now, that's not true in the case of journaling, say, when people write to get their own thoughts sorted out in their own head. But for most people that want people to, you know, buy their books and read their articles, they come to this realization that this is about communication. So if something doesn't communicate in a way that's satisfying or successful, then it requires some thought and some revision. Mm-hmm. And I'll go back, you know, even in something like on my blog, and somebody will make a comment, and I might go back and change the blog if I feel that I've miscommunicated something.
Okay. that leads me to one of the questions that I wanted to get to you about, because I think you've already answered it, but I'll see whether I'm right in this one. Your blog, your website had the top 10 worst reasons to write a young adult novel. So I'm thinking that your answer is, well, we'll do some of these. Number one, for fame. Number two, for fortune. Number three, to tell teens how they should act. Number four, to tell teens what it was like when you were a kid. And it goes down there. So you didn't put on there the top 10 best reason to write.
No.
Right. And the top one seems to be communication for you.
Well, yeah. I mean, but that's not specifically a reason to write a YA novel, mm-hmm. But it's a specific reason to write. I mean, probably the top reason, I haven't actually edited this down in my head, but probably the main reason that I write YA novels instead of something else is because that's when my reading experiences and my life experience were the most intense and the most memorable. It was those books that I read between the age of 10 and 16 probably that had the most impact on me as a writer. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't necessarily relate to the quality of the work either. I mean, I was as profoundly affected by From Russia with Love as I was by The Idiot, which I read probably, Dostoevsky's Idiot, which I probably read within a year or two of each other. And they both had a big effect on me. Lord of the Rings was huge. I mean, I lived inside that book. I read the whole thing. I went back to the beginning. I read the whole thing again.
You're listening to Writer's Talk from The Ohio State University with my guest, Pete Houtman, author of 19 novels and an active website at www.petehoutman.com. His novel, Godless, won the National Book Award for Young People. His next book, The Big Crunch, will debut this week, so check your local bookseller for that. Writer's Talk is a co-production of the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing and The Ohio Channel. Now, back to a discussion of Houtman's literary influences. You've got a list of some of the authors that really impacted you, and some of the favorite ones are Octavia Butler, Samuel Delaney, J.R.R. Tolkien, and that I thought I had glommed onto something new because you're starting a sci-fi trilogy, The Klaatu Discos,
right,
which is just got picked up. It'll be out in 2012.
Right.
So I thought, oh, you're moving into science fiction from young adult. But Rash was sci-fi.
Yes.
What attracts you about science fiction, and do you see it as a departure from what you've been doing in young adult, with the exception of this one, which is the one I'm familiar with?
I don't know that I see, this is really a departure. I wrote two other sci-fi books before, Mr. Was and Hole in the Sky,
okay,
which were very different kinds of science fiction. Hole in the Sky was an after-the-apocalypse type science fiction, after most of the people in the world are dead, how the survivors get along. And Mr. Was a very personal little time travel story. Klaatu Discos is another time travel story. And it feels pretty much the same to me as other writing that I've done. I'm also working on a fantasy, working on a book with elves, because I really, really want to write about elves.
Okay. I didn't know if you meant as co-writers with the elves or how that went. Because that's the Tolkien influence.
Right.
Clearly, which I didn't mean to sort of lump in with Butler and Delaney.
My elves are nasty. Tolkien's elves are, they have some good personal qualities. My elves have no good personal qualities.
Mm. Why is that? What made you decide elves were bad?
I introduced them into the story, and they started doing these really mean things, and they just sort of evolved that way.
Walk me through a day of writing for you.
Day of writing?
A day of writing for you, and tell me what makes it a successful day.
Oh, well, coffee.
Okay.
First, and then I sit down and I look at what I've been working on. I'm usually working on several novels, not simultaneously, but in any given week I'll probably work on three different books at one time or another. And I'll decide what I want to work on, and I'll usually type something, page or two. I'll look at it, I'll go back, I'll rewrite what serves me as an outline, because what I just wrote completely screws up what I thought I was going to do. And it's a lot of back and forth. I'll lay down on the sofa and I'll close my eyes and I'll think for a little bit. And sometimes I fall asleep. Sometimes I wake up, get up, and I write some more. Sometimes I go for a walk. But it kind of goes like in little spurts through the day. A successful day of writing is, there's two kinds. There's one when I write a bunch of pages. And to me, a bunch of pages would be more than three, almost never more than seven or eight in a day. And that feels good because I've achieved mass. You know, I've increased the mass, the theoretical mass of the manuscript. Mm-hmm. The other kind of successful day is when I figure something out about a story and I go, oh yeah, I could make Darth Vader Luke's father. You know, when something clicks and comes together and a story wraps back on itself, and all of a sudden, because as I'm writing, I'll have all these little threads. Like Mary and I read all of each other's work. And so she was reading the first volume of Klaatu Discos, and she says, well, why do you have this character Will in here? He doesn't need to be there. And I go, well, I'm saving him. She said, what for? I said, I don't know yet. You know, I said, but I, you know, he's there if I need him, and I mention him from time to time. And I said, maybe in book two, he's going to become important. And she said, what if he doesn't? I said, well, then I'll go back and take him out of book one. But there's, you know, it's like all these little threads and trying to have them touch each other in ways that feel significant. Mm-hmm. So I can have a day where I have negative page production, you know, where I actually delete three pages instead of write three pages. And if I've figured something out that I feel improves the shape and the strength of the story, then that would be a successful day. It's also a successful day if I get a big check in the mail.
Okay. All right. I'm looking for those days as well. If you could help me out with that, I would really appreciate it. You've talked about, you said you read each other's work, Mary Logue, and you both read each. And then you've also co-authored some of these mysteries together.
Yep.
Tell me the difference between, I assume it's quantitative, the difference between reading each other's stuff and commenting on it and writing together. How do you work those differently?
Yeah, well, Mary and I knew each other as members of a critique group before we became romantically involved. And so we've related as writers ever since we met, pretty much. But reading each other's manuscripts, like if I read her manuscript, I might make 10 or 12 marks per page. A lot of times questioning words choices, saying, wow, that's really nice, you know, various kinds of remarks. Mm-hmm. The co-authoring was very different. We went into it blind. We just started writing. And we had two characters, a boy and a girl, and originally we thought she'd write the girl and I'd write the boy. But by the time we had 10 pages written, we were stepping all over each other. You know, I was rewriting her boy stuff, she was rewriting my girl stuff, then she'd write, you know, two scenes, one from the boy's point of view and one from the girl's point of view, and then I'd tear her scene in half and I'd add something else. And by the time we finished the book, 80% of that book, I could not tell you who wrote a particular scene. Some of them I remember writing and some of them I remember her writing, but it was a very organic back and forth process with a lot of rewriting. And I would say it wasn't painful. It wasn't so bad emotionally. I mean, it wasn't like we were fighting, but it's just hard to have your writing stepped on every day, even if it's getting stepped on in a good way.
Mm-hmm. Is that how you describe it to each other? You've been stepping on my writing, or you've been working with my writing. I appreciate what you've done. It seems like you said you're not fighting, but that's the moment where it becomes the difficult negotiation, because what if she's got something she's really liked written and you change it? How do you negotiate that with her?
Well, neither Mary nor I have a big attachment to particular words and sentences and things. We're both extremely receptive to editorial input. And there are times when she will suggest something to me and I'll ignore her, and times when I'll suggest something to her and she'll ignore me. but they're few and far between.
Is she also an outliner when she writes? I mean, you had said you will discard your outlines. Yeah. I'm curious how often the sort of outlines in your head.
Yeah, well, when I see an outline, like an outline for the Klaatu Discos, which is going to run to about 900 pages, I think, is about 3 pages long. So it's very, very, very loose. Mm-hmm. And Mary's pretty much the same way. Cool. You know, I have a good friend who writes mysteries whose outline goes to 40 pages for a 70,000 word book. And he'll work for months on the outline, and then he'll write the book in a month. So he actually spends more time planning it. I mean, he's got it right down to the chapter breaks and exactly what happens in each chapter. Man, I have tried to work that way, and I cannot do it. I don't know why. It makes sense. I mean, if you have the kind of mind that can do that, you know, that can create a story like that and then actually follow your own outline without letting a bunch of, you know, I mean, if I was doing that, I'd have some character would walk in and say something to totally destroy the rest of the outline by page 6.
But can't you get rid of the character then? Why is it that you're holding onto the character if that happens and you recognize that happening? What makes you value that character over the outline?
Well, some characters are more fun to spend time with than others. And I mean, if I've got two characters having a conversation and they're moving the story forward in their conversation, they're having coffee and they're figuring something out, and then for some reason I decide their friend Chuck should walk into the room and say or do something really interesting or outrageous, instead of going, I have to get rid of Chuck, where my mind goes is, how can I take this outrageous thing and make it work further down the story? How can I weave it in? You know, how can I make this as complicated and difficult and maddening as I possibly can?
Why do you think that appeals to you? Why do you think that sense of maddening and difficult plotting appeals to you? Is it a challenge to see if you can get yourself out of it?
The challenge is certainly part of it. Stubbornness is also part of it. If I have an idea for something, I really... You know, if I have an idea to, you know, hang a painting on a wall and there's no stud where I want to hang the painting, it's like I'm the kind of person that will tear the wall down and put a new stud up in order to hang the painting where I want it. It's not a personality trait that is particularly useful to me, and I can't recommend it to anyone.
But it goes over well in the writing of books. It helps.
Well, it works for me. It took me a long time to figure out how to do it. I mean, I was trying to write books for 20 years before I succeeded, so it took a long time for me to figure out how to work around who I am.
Okay. Last question. In 30 seconds, who are the authors that most influence you when you're writing? Who do you think of when you're writing? You have a very long list on your website.
Yeah, well, I think of P.G. Wodehouse. I think of James M. Cain. I think of Elmore Leonard.
Okay.
Actually, Elmore Leonard was probably one of the biggest influences on me writing work that was publishable.
Okay. Well, Pete Houtman, I want to thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure.
For more from author Pete Houtman, visit Writers Talk on the web at www.writerstalk.org. Writers Talk is a co-production of the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University and The Ohio Channel, where you can watch our interviews by either surfing to www.ohiochannel.org or by checking your local cable listings for our broadcast times. You can also find us on iTunes by searching under Writers Talk or under Ohio Writers. You can follow us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/writerstalk. Join me next time for a two-parter, first with OSU student writers who wrote the script for the Martin Luther King Day celebration in Columbus on January 17th, and then for upcoming Six String Concerts guest David Francie, whose song Skating Rink you now hear in the background. Until next time, this is Doug Dangler. Keep writing.
high above, forever looking down. And I'm standing, looking upward, and I'm listening to the sound of the village in the lonely heart of winter. And the lights above the skating rink illuminate the scene. And on the snow the shadows show footsteps where we've been. And Danny's breath hangs motionless and high.